Okay, so today's sutta, the Salayaka Sutta, Majjhima 41, dealing with the Brahmins of Sala, a village near Kosala, or in the Kosalan district. This being one of the rare suttas which doesn't have any corresponding versions in Chinese or Sanskrit or anywhere else. The bulk of the sutta is dealing with the 10 Kusala Kammapata, the Dasa Kusala Kammapata, and that's a very common topic. So that topic is treated in the tens of the Anguttara Nikaya and also in its own chapter in the Samyukta Agama in Chinese. So of course there'd be many suttas that have basically identical content in terms of the doctrines, but none of them are actually given this setting of being taught at Sala to the Brahmins of Sala. Why that is so?
You can't just say it doesn't.
But it does raise interesting questions, like what do we mean when we say this is a sutta, for example, right? We say this is a sutta, but the Buddha taught the same teachings many times during his career. And what is it that distinguishes one sutta from another? I mean, we think of a sutta as being like a discrete occasion. Yeah, so there was actually one particular occasion when the Buddha gave a teaching. And so he gave the same teaching on another occasion to other people, maybe identical or very similar teaching, but we don't necessarily regard them as the same sutta. Yeah? On the other hand, so that depends on what kind of questions we want to ask, okay? And that will inform the kinds of information that we get out, okay? So if we want to ask, for example, the question, this group, the 10 ways of wholesome karma, are they found in the different schools of Buddhism, right? So if we want to ask that question, then we can look and we find many sutras with the same teaching in it in the different schools of Buddhism and with no particular difference between them, okay? So we can say, well, that's the case. We might want to ask a different kind of question. We might want to ask, was there any particular association between the Pali school, which went to Sri Lanka, and the Kosalan country? We might suspect that there's some kind of connection there. And then we find, oh, there's this sutta given in Kosala, which is found only in here and not found in other collections. So why is that? Well, perhaps when the Buddha went to the Kosalan area, he gave this sutta. The local bhikkhus in that area remembered that sutta. Yeah? Other bhikkhus in other areas didn't remember that particular sutta. And so when the compilation of the suttas were made, if there was a school or a group of monks that had a connection with those ones, then it would tend to incorporate that and other monks wouldn't. So even though the doctrine's the same, you still might be able to learn something about the history. Now that's just pure... just an example. I'm not saying that actually is the case in this case. Obviously, you'd need a larger amount of different examples of the same kind of thing to be able to reach any conclusion there. But this is sometimes the reason why we, go nitpicking. And
it's later.
It's quite possible. Yeah.
But it's, that's probably to say that it's not actually literally the word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if. Usually, typically, if something is shared between the different collections, then that increases the chance of it being an early. That's a hypothesis. It's not a proof. It's a hypothesis. So things which are not shared, by that standard, could be later. Although it doesn't prove that they're later, but it's one indication. Okay, so this particular sutta again is very quite short and simple. One occasion, the Blessed One was wandering by stages in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and eventually he arrived at a Kosalan Brahman village named Sala. Okay, a number of suttas were given at Sala, but not much else is known about it. The Brahman householders of Sala heard that the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans who went forth from a Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus and has come to Sala. Now a good report of the Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, this generation with its recluses and brahmans, its princes and people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. So this, of course, being a stock phrase describing the Buddha and his Dhamma teachings. Many different suttas. It's a very nice passage to chat, that one. Now, Brahmin householders of Sala went to the Blessed One, paid homage to him. Some of them paid homage and sat down at one side. Some exchanged greetings. When the courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. So again, another stock passage indicating people's different level of faith and reverence for the Buddha. So, the question. What is the cause and condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in states of deprivation in an unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell? And what is the cause and condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in a happy destination even in the heavenly world? Okay, so obviously this being a question of great concern for people generally, and one of the sort of core things that religions say they can answer. And people who are skeptical of religions are generally very skeptical of these claims to be able to say who goes to heaven and who goes to hell and so on. And these ideas have become under a lot of skeptical criticism and so on in recent years, as they were indeed in the time of the Buddha even. So the actual question here, Gonu ko godma hetu, so what is the cause, the hetu, go pachayo. So as Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated, this is the usual translation of cause, as hetu is cause, pachaya is condition. One shouldn't think that that implies a difference in meaning between these two things. Actually, they're just synonyms. And in the early suttas, hetu and pachaya are just synonyms. They don't have any different meaning. Later on, they came to be distinguished in meaning.
Not really changing, through not changing?
Hetu, pachaya, yeah. So the hetu, in that case, pachaya is a general term for any kind of condition. It's in the patana, abhidhamma patana. Whereas hetu means specifically the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. That's a specifically abhidhammic usage. Yenami dehekache, so where here certain beings, after kayasa beheda, after the breaking up of the body, paramarana, after death, go to an apaya, a hell state of loss and woe. Dugati, a realm of miserable existence, right? Literally a bad destiny. Vinipatang, that's literally the downfall, the abyss. Nirayang, hell, upapajanati, so is reborn.
So, Bhikkhu Bodhi might give a talk on this one, and he says that, he talks about how some modern day people like to interpret, rebirthing the hungry ghost from the realm.
Mm.
You had some greed or something right. In his present lifetime.
Right.
But he uses this passage to refute that doctrine,
mm.
saying that at the breaking up of the body after death,
yeah.
It says here.
Absolutely, yeah. There's
rebirth is not something that happens spontaneously, the mind continues here.
For sure, yeah. So there's definitely no justification for the idea that early Buddhism didn't teach about rebirth and birth in heaven and hell and so on. This is sort of a modern secularist tendency to question these things, and it's kind of missing the point. I mean, just to look at that question about heaven and hell and the meaning of it in Buddhism, you know, sort of, and why it's been subject to secular critiques, then I think it's important to understand that in its historical context. So in Western context, which our modern secular society has come up from, you had this idea of heaven and hell, states of rebirth and so on, which were somehow fundamentally different from the world in which we live. Okay? And that distinction, that idea that they're fundamentally different, was rooted in, among other things, in ancient Greek thought, where you had this idea which is formulated from the writing, thinking of people like Plato and Aristotle. You had this idea of like this temporal world where down here on earth everything was, you know, changing, impermanent, in flux, unsatisfactory, everything. And then that was contrasted with this heavenly world where you could see, and the paradigm for that was the stars. Okay, so you can see the stars, and the stars have like a kind of perfection. They're eternal and they're perfect. And in the Greek system, the gods and goddesses would be actually identified with certain stars, okay? And so that was like an expression of their immortality. And so then Aristotle asked the question, well, why don't stars fall out of the sky? Right? Everything we have down here falls down by the means of gravity. Why don't stars fall out of the sky? Yeah? And so the answer was that, well, they operate according to basically a different set of rules. They don't work according to the kinds of rules which apply down here, because we can see everything here falls down, whereas the stars don't. And so this is this strand of thinking which developed in the West, where there was like this quite contrast between the world in which we live in, the temporal world, and the other world, which came to be named the metaphysics, okay, meaning after the physics. It's a term based on Aristotle's writing, although he didn't actually use it. But so in the metaphysical realm, everything is different, fundamentally different from how it is in our realm, okay? Beings live forever, okay? So this is one difference. Here everything changes, but there it's all permanent. So if you go to hell, it's permanent. If you go to heaven, it's permanent, right? And this is, that's just like a fact or a part of the structure of those different kinds of realms. And this is one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that one's going to those realms was basically entirely contingent on sort of adhering to a certain view, okay? So having a certain faith, so I'm going to believe in the tenets of such and such a religion or whatever, therefore I'm going to go to one of those realms. So it's dependent on a kind of belief in a kind of a view. I mean, there's many other aspects of it, but these are some basic ideas. Now, when the scientific people started to criticize this, of course, it started to break down. We started to realize, well, the stars, you have the theory of gravity and so on. You realize, well, the stars are actually operating according to the same principles that we are. There's no kind of great division between what we're doing down here and what we're doing up there. And this was the great insight of people like Newton, who saw that the whole universe is actually structured on what are effectively the same kinds of laws. I mean, that's something which is still controversial in physics, but that was the assumption of Newton. And then in the 19th century, you had laws of thermodynamics, and the laws of thermodynamics were specifically formulated in order to stop any metaphysical, to discount the existence of any metaphysical entities, and to stop any metaphysical entities from interfering in the world. Okay. And so some of the ideas are that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Okay, so there's like a proportionality between cause and effect. This is one of the implications of that. So how can you do something which is a limited or finite action which reaps an infinite result? Okay, so this is one of the problems with the kind of Christian cosmology. You do a finite act and it has an infinite result. Yeah. And so what you have is a disjunct between what things of this world and things of a completely other kind, and it's very hard to ever cross over between those two things. Yeah. So how can we in our temporal world have any kind of relationship with a sphere that's timeless and yet wants to interfere with the world? Okay. All of these kinds of things are come into play, and then of course you have the problem of, you know, going to heaven because of some belief structure. What happens if you were born in Fiji or something like that? You never heard of Jesus. You know, you're going to go to hell because you've never heard of Jesus. Now, this is another problem which they had to grapple with. So there's many different kinds of problems and issues with this kind of idea which specifically come from that worldview and that context. Now, when we look at how heaven and hell applied in Buddhist context, a lot of those problems simply don't apply in a Buddhist context, and this is something which I think is not sufficiently appreciated by a lot of the secularists who want to do away with heaven and hell. The basic difference is that heaven and hell are never conceived of as being places that are fundamentally different from this realm. Okay, they're places which are contingently different from this world. You have a longer lifespan, maybe, but not an infinitely long lifespan. Okay, so if we have a lifespan of 100 years here, well, it's possible for us to imagine being born in a place where we have a lifespan of 1,000 years, or even 1,000,000 years, even 100 trillion years, okay? But that's still not permanent, okay? And there's still a massive gulf between a lifespan of 100 trillion years and a lifespan of infinity, okay? Which is what we're looking at in Christianity. So, we do a certain act in Buddhism, a good act or a bad act, and that breeds a certain kind of result, yeah? And the worse that the act is, the worse the result. So there's a kind of proportionality. We don't believe that you have to adhere to Buddhism to be able to go to heaven or whatever, like anything like that, and so on and so forth. So many of the problems which really plague the Christian notions of heaven and hell simply don't apply in the case of Buddhism. Okay, the heavenly realms and the hell realms are not supposed to be something which are kind of separated or which is separated in any kind of fundamental way, they're not like a fundamentally different kind of being. Okay, they're just variations on what we can experience here. So there's always the connections between those things.
So it's purely experiential, really.
No way.
Because there's no self,
ultimately. Yeah.
Then it's all experience. Mm-hmm. So because there's no permanent soul.
Yeah.
There can't be a permanent place for that soul.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if you're just mind getting around, then there's got to be continuum.
Yeah.
Because that's all mind is.
Yeah. Yeah. So that doesn't mean that there aren't any problems with Buddhist ideas of heaven and hell if we look at it from a secular light, okay, or we investigate it from a scientific realm. It doesn't prove that it's true, okay, and it doesn't mean that Buddhism isn't subject to critiques from science or anything like that. But it does mean that the basic philosophical foundations that the critiques are made on are quite different. So, you know, Buddhism would still be subject to an empirical critique. So science might still say, well, where are these heaven and hells? You know, we've dug down deep, we haven't found any hells under the ground, we've flown up spaceships into the sky, we haven't found any heavens up there, where are they? So that kind of critique would still be valid, and I don't think Buddhism has an answer to that question, right? Or particularly... coherent way.
Quantum physicists, they might not see it quite like that.
How might they see it if they're a quantum physicist?
Well, in terms of experiential, like, or in terms of Schrodinger's cat, you know, which is the observer is at all in an experiment.
Yeah.
You know, which is just like the tree falling in the
forest. Yeah, sure. I mean, we can say those kinds of things. But that still wouldn't satisfy an empiricist. Those things might have a might indicate a direction in which an inquiry might go. But from an empirical point of view, the scientist might still well say, "Fine, prove it," right? And Buddhists haven't really done anything very much to do that. I mean, there has been some research on past life stuff and things like that. So there has been some things, it's interesting. You know, I mean, certainly there's no doubt that traditional Buddhists believed, and some still do, many still do, that, you know, heaven is down there under the ground, hell is down there under the ground, and heaven's up there in the sky. You know, that's the traditional Buddhist belief. You know, no doubt about that. So
the similarity between the Christian and the Buddhist belief, I guess, is quite close. And that's the way it's sort of the Christian.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Pretty universal.
I don't know if it is. I don't think it's quite universal, but certainly common among another number of different religions. Like in the ancient Judaic text, doesn't have that kind of idea of heaven and hell. Nor do the Greeks really. I mean, the Greeks had their Olympus up on the mountain, but that's not like a place where you get born. It's only a place where the gods live.
And Hades is a place you travel to, rather.
Everyone goes to the underworld.
Yeah, everyone goes to the Hades. Yeah, which they have different realms for good and bad people, so it's a little bit similar, but it's not. And not exactly the same. So the Brahmins of Sala are asking the question in the right way. They're asking an intelligent question, because they're asking, what's the cause? And of course this is the, many religions say, well, your cause is you do ritual, or you do some kind of chanting, or you give lots of money to the temple or something, and then you go to heaven. And so... the Buddha gave his own answer, adhammacarya visamacarya. Unrighteous, undhamma, adhamma, conduct, and visama. So here sama is as in even, same, visama, uneven, conduct. Okay, so it's unrighteous conduct and how do you translate that in English? Anyway, it means, it doesn't, it's not used in that kind of so literal a sense, it just means wrong conduct, basically. Not good conduct. Okay. So through bad conduct, bad unrighteous conduct, and so on, then they go to hell. And through righteous conduct, then they go to the Sugati and the Sagan Lokan. Then the Brahmins of Sala answered, We do not understand the detailed meaning of the Master Gotama's utterance, which he has spoken in brief without expanding the detailed meaning. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach us the Dhamma so that we might understand the detailed meaning of this utterance. So the Sankhita is the brief, I think literally tossed together, and the Vitara is the expanded meaning. And of course this being the... Which particular case is this? Sankhitena?
Instrumental.
Ah, very good. Very good. So, instrumental. So you translate in brief, but actually with brief, or briefly. Bahasitasa. Vitarena in extenso. Alright. So the Blessed One said this. There are now three kinds. Ti vidhang. Lay people, of by the body, kayena. So again, instrumental, kayena, with the body, dhammacharya, so unrighteous conduct with the body. Four kinds, chatu bidang, with the speech, okay, and three kinds with the mind. Alright, so notice that in this case, the kaya, vacha, and manasa are body, speech, and mind. They're all singular instrumental cases here, but they all look very different, don't they? Kayena, the ending there. Vachaya is a feminine instrumental ending. And then Manasa. So they all look like totally different endings, but they're actually the same. So this is a long A ending. Just keep your nitrites. Okay, so three kinds of bodily conduct. Here someone lives... kills living beings. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Okay. Then he takes what is not given. He takes by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or forest. Okay. So the first one obviously being the precept against killing. This being the precept against stealing. Okay. Dinanteya sankatang. So this, the phrasing of this being quite similar to the Bhikkhu's Parajika rule on stealing. Gamangwa, Aranyangwa, Adinang Teya Sankatang, Adyeya. So it's very similar.
And then
merciless,
what's
that? Here we go. Hoti Luddo is violent. Lohitapani, bloody handed. Hatupahate, killed, injured, carried, Niwitto. Maybe that one. Let me have a look. Merciless, bloody hand again, merciless to living beings. Adaya pano here. Yeah. Adaya. Daya, I think, is mercy. Daya is mercy. Adaya, yeah.
Makes a negative.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so those definitions of the first two precepts. And this one, the third precept, is actually quite an interesting one. So this gives us this is the most detailed kind of description in the suttas on what the third precept means. He misconducts himself in sensual pleasures. Kamesu michachara. So here we have, what's the word kamesu? Okay. And what case is that? Anyone want to figure out a guess here? Kamesu. Locative. Locative plural. Very good. Very good. Okay. And he has intercourse with women who are protected by their mother, father, mother and father, brother, sister or relatives who have a husband who are protected by law, and even those who are garlanded in token of betrothal. Okay? So this is the third precept. So it's very interesting in some ways. So obviously, for a start, obviously it's phrased from a male perspective. Okay, not talking about it from a female perspective, but that's obviously just a way of phrasing. The main idea here seems to be that in ancient India, the women were under the guard, here using the word rakita, the protection, of somebody at every stage of their life. So here it says, well, either they're under the guard of their mother, or of their father, or their mother and father, or their brother. So notice all of these words are related to the English words. Mata, matu is related to mata, for mother. Pitu is related to father, as in paternal. Bhata is brother. Bhagini is sister. That's not related to the English word sister, just in case you're wondering. Nyati, rakita, so protected by family. Gota rakita, protected by clan. Dhamma rakita, protected by Dhamma. How's he translated that? Protected by law, he's translated it. Sasamika is with a husband. Okay, so the husband. Ah, interesting. Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't seem to translate Dhamma rakita. It says protected by, have a husband, protected by law. Saparidanda. Anyway, seems to be a bit different. Anyway, sasamika. Sami is the word for a husband. Literally means lord.
What's the Thai word for husband?
Sami. Anyone have a problem with that?
Well, I have quite a problem with the way the Thais treat their wives as a result of her attitude. I don't have any problem with the label.
With the label, yeah. Yeah. Sasamika. Saparidanda. Antamaso. Yeah, it seems to mean saparidanda, protected by law, have a husband. It seems to be the one that Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated as protected by law, but protected saparidanda, I'm not 100% sure of that word, but presumably that's what it means. But then what does the Dhamma rakita mean? I'm not sure. Saparidanda. Danda is by weapon or by punishment.
And pari is all, is it?
Pari, yeah.
All weapon protected?
Yeah, not sure. So, and then Andamaso Mala, and even as much as the Mala is a garland of flowers, in token of betrayal, or betrothal even. Okay, Mala Gula Parikata. Okay, so I guess that's like an engagement thing. Yeah, you know, sort of like you give an engagement ring. So you guess you give a Mala to sort of indicate that you're going to be married. So the basic idea here is that the sexual misconduct relates to some betrayal of some kind of socially accepted contract, yeah, or socially accepted position. So that the woman in this case, as the example that's given, is in some kind of relationship where it's understood that she's protected and looked after. So having intercourse in that particular relationship would be a betrayal of that particular the agreement or the contract that's taken under. So it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting a number of things that it doesn't cover. I mean, first of all, compared with what we find often in religions, Christianity and so on, it doesn't cover any particular sexual acts. Okay, so there's nothing about actually what you're doing. Right, and Buddhism's not sort of going around forcing people to do missionary position or anything like that. You know, this is not part of it. It's about the emotional betrayal. It's not about the actual physical acts that people are getting up to. And secondly, of course, there's nothing about homosexuality or lesbians or anything like that.
Or incest,
for that matter. Yeah.
Or pedophilia.
Or pedophilia.
If you're under the protection of...
Yeah, that was protection of those people. Yeah, they're under protection. But what it doesn't account also is doesn't cover just ordinary adult consensual sex. Okay, so there's no requirement that people have to be married. Okay, to be count. So adultery in Buddhism doesn't require that people have to be married, and that's quite accepted within the Indian tradition. Within the Indian tradition generally, they have a number of different kinds of marriage which they correlate with the different heavenly realms, right? So you've got the Tusita Deva marriage and the Brahman marriage and so on, which are appropriate for different castes and different levels of people and so on. And the lowest level of marriage they call the Gandharva marriage, and that features quite prominently in Indian fables and so on. The Gandharva marriage essentially is when a man and a woman decide to go for it. And that's about it. And that's considered to be a quite appropriate form of marriage in Indian society. It's still, even if it's just between the two who decide to run off together.
This garland thing is not sex before marriage. It's simply somebody else's betrothed. So don't go chasing fiancé.
Something like that, yeah. And it might be like young girls or something like that, you know, because in Indian society there would be, you know.
Before birth.
Jesus. So even though the exact details, obviously the exact details of how this applies is quite different these days. I think that it's pretty clear the kinds of principles that we can derive from it, that the important thing is betrayal of some kind of bond or some kind of agreement between people. Yeah, and that's obviously what causes the emotional pain of that. And that's what Buddhist sexual ethics should really be concerned with.
Natasha might have something to offer on this question. She said some of her calls on around people around sexual misconduct, how much pain that brings.
Sure, yeah, you know, because you get it from both sides. You get the person that's actually cheated, and then the remorse that they have, and then you'll get the other side, not necessarily in the same relationship, but the person that's been cheated on, and the pain, especially if they've been in a relationship for, you know, a long period of time, can be excruciating. Smashing. So, I mean, it's just such dangerous ground to pick up, you know. I mean, the one tells you one thing about the excitement and the anticipation of it all, but you really have to pay back big time.
Okay, and how householders are there four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct? Here someone speaks falsehood when summoned to a court or to a meeting. So that's interesting. Sabhaga, summoned to a sabhaga, a court. Sabha, sorry, not sabhaga, sabha. Like a court, or not necessarily court as we would understand it, but also like an assembly or something like that. A parisa, also like an assembly. It's like you'd have, I mean, in those days, you didn't have such formal court systems and things like we had these days, but you'd have like a meeting hall in the centre of the village, and either if it was in the capital, then the king would adjudicate, otherwise it might be a council of the elders of the village or something like that, and people would bring their cases there, and there's a few times in Buddhist texts where these things are discussed, like when Visakha, there was a court case and the elders of the village came to decide it. Okay, or in the middle of the family, or to the guild, the puga, inside the guild. The puga is like an association of people of a particular craft or work. Or to the royal family's presence, Rajakula, and questioned as a witness thus. So, good man, tell what you know. Okay. So Ajanang Janami and not Janang Apasangwaha. So saying he knows when saying I know, what is it? Not knowing he says I know, or knowing he says I do not know, not seeing he says I see, or seeing he says I do not see. In full awareness he speaks falsehood for his own ends or for another's ends or for some trifling worldly end. Okay? For his own ends and another ends or some amisa kincha ka hetu. Some worldly end. And so the operative thing here is the sampajana, which is the kind of deliberate or fully conscious. And in the Bhikkhu's Vinaya, it talks about that some more, and it gives a number of exceptions. It says it doesn't count if you're speaking quickly, if you're speaking in jest, if you're joking around, and so on. But you have to know, to be really sampajana musa, it really has to be beforehand, you know I'm going to tell a lie. While you're speaking, you know I'm telling a lie, and then after you're speaking, you know I've told a lie. Okay, so that's to really sort of count for that. So it really means a deliberate lie in a serious situation. Okay, and also notice that the context that this was asked in was the context of, you know, when do you go to hell? You know, and where do you get bad karma and go to rebirth? So the example that it's giving is, you know, a fairly serious example of a lie. It's not like a white lie or something like that, which would also be considered as breaking the precept. But these are considered, you know, even today, these are considered very serious things. If you go and stand in front of a court and deliberately and quite consciously say something which you know to be false, then that's obviously a very heavy example of telling a lie.
It's the way that in film or in television, you know, when one character lies, it's really depicted quite strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Explaining myself very well, but you can actually see it in the character. You can see the effect that it's having on him to lie.
Right. Yeah.
Like it has an effect on you when you lie.
Yeah, well, it immediately sets up a barrier between yourself and somebody else, or between yourself and everybody else. You start to, you know, like Shakespeare said, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. And you start to build up this internal world where there's this gap between you and everybody else, and you have to sort of bear that in mind. And if you want to maintain the lie, then you can't go across that, you know? So you have to sort of keep on going, building up separation between yourself and others in order to maintain the deception.
And there's also always a relationship as well, and there's likely certain contexts that people can tell the truth more easily.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't seem to be just the individual on the dock who has a responsibility for telling the truth, but everyone to create a context where truth can be spoken and heard and acted on. Because I think there's very good reasons why some people in these kinds of situations do lie.
Uh-huh.
So kind of seems like a communal responsibility, not just...
Yeah, sure. Like what kinds of things would you be thinking of?
I guess like in court, if it just comes down to whoever's the cleverest lawyer, for example, with the case, and there's not a real investigation of truth. Or in, I guess, situations in wartime when I guess context where there's not really an interest in real truth. And where people's words could be used against them and it becomes unsafe to tell the truth. And that can be in all kinds of levels of society, I think, when we kind of get locked into deceptions, partly because of ourselves, but partly because of this, you know, social conditioning.
I mean, I guess if you're in a relationship with somebody and you lie to them, then the implication is that you don't believe that they're capable of forgiving you or understanding what you've done.
And that you don't have a proper relationship, and so that's impossible to tell the truth. Like, that's the other thing as well.
Yeah.
So I think being able to tell the truth is being in relationship, obviously.
Yeah.
If you can't, you're not in relationship. And so in some of these situations that people get put in, they're not in really a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the classic sort of car salesman who believes their own bull?
You know? Like, a used car salesman or US president or whatever.
Yeah. Like, if, you know, if the person is convinced that what they're speaking is the truth, but the global consensus is that they're full of it, then what ethically, you know? Do they still have to reap the same karma?
It goes with the taste, isn't it? It's fine. Yeah,
and then you're not really in a relationship, like you're just trying to push your idea on someone else's. Well, if you're the US president or you're a salesperson, that's not really an exchange. So that would be exactly the kind of context for truth telling isn't really.
But then there's another issue of like in certain people in certain contexts aren't necessarily expected to know things. You don't have a responsibility to know it. Whereas if you are, say, poor old George, but if you are, for example, the president of the US, then you have a certain kind of obligation to inform yourself as to the truth before you go bombing another country or something like that. Whereas if somebody else was to spout off their own opinions, it's not necessarily, you know, such a big deal. Yeah, very interesting. Now, then the next one is the first kind of wrong speech. Then he speaks maliciously. Okay. Pisuna vacha vacho kopanahoti. Okay. Having heard it from there, and then he repeats elsewhere what he's heard here in order to divide those people from these, or he repeats to these people what he's heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he's one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, who enjoys discord, rejoices in discord, delights in discord, and a speaker of words that create discord. So the vaga here, the word for discord is vaga. It's groups like separated out. Okay? And parosa, okay, that kind of speech which is rough, hard, andaka, Gakasa. Gakasa. It means hard. Parakatuka. Hurtful to others. Offensive to others. Parabhisajjani. Bordering on anger. Okay. Unconducive to concentration. Asamadhi sangvatanika.
Like different temperaments, don't they?
Right.
People, you know, when you first meet them, they come across as being very direct and very, you know, but then you speak, you see them talking to someone else in that way, and you say, you know, that's just the way they are. And,
right, yeah, you have to. No, you have to make allowances for those things, you know. Like there was one, for example, there's one novice. I bought an Anachat, a Malaysian novice, and he had an extremely loud voice, and all the people in the kitchen used to complain about it, okay? And then they found out that before he was a novice, he used to work in a disco for like 15 years, you know? So they could understand why his voice tended to be on the loud side. And, yeah, that's true. So, but also to be very sensitive to how your speech affects others. Some people, you know, you can speak in different ways with different kinds of people. Sampapalapi is meaningless gossip, speaking at the wrong time. Akalavadi. So what's the wrong time? Most of the time. Yeah. Abhutavadi, unreal. Anattavadi, pointless. Adhammavadi, avinayavadi. Anidhanavatinga, vachang. Okay, words that are worthless. Anidhanavatinga, the means worth treasuring. Literally, is worth treasuring. Words that are not worth treasuring. Kale anapadesang aparyantavating. Okay, this is aparyantavating, immoderate. Okay, and that's a good one to remember. Aparyanta vating, anta is an end.
End.
Okay. Yeah, aparyanta vating.
Without end.
Words that just don't have any end. This is the fourth kind of wrong conduct. So remember what this is. So of course, you have lots of forms of communication that are not necessarily
beneficial.
Speech. And to what extent should these be considered right speech or wrong speech?
Is that like
I guess you have two kinds. I mean, really, you have one which is a kind of a normal kind of thing where people will simply criticize other people behind their backs, right? So maybe something happens, you didn't like it, or you didn't like what the person did, or whatever, and so you repeat that and then criticize it or something. Yeah. So that's one thing. Another thing is where there's more like a conscious manipulativeness about it, where you're actually quite deliberately trying to put people offside and to form people into groups and things like that, you know? And so I think this is more talking about that. I mean, not to say that generally critical speech can be good or bad. I mean, you have to criticize what should be criticized. This is what the Buddha said. You should criticize what should be criticized, yeah? He never said you shouldn't criticize everything. But the point here is like, you know, what are you actually trying to do with that criticism? What's your motive, you know?
Trying to put on the side in the malicious, unwholesome.
Yeah, like kind of politicking it and sort of trying to,
is that kind of like,
you know, like them and us and...
Is that the schism thing? Similar to this?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, you know, the kind of... It would be like what happened with the, say, with the Second Council, and the monks were going around before the Second Council trying to win over people and trying to sort of offer them gifts so that you could have come on our side and these kinds of things. Yeah.
So the average schoolboy, schoolgirl kind of
put down.
Yeah, put down and criticizing and things like that would fall under the first case that you mentioned, is that right?
Sometimes. But also under rough speech. Yeah. the way kids use speech is very... Okay. So, three kinds of mental conduct. Here, someone is covetous. Well, covetous is abhijalu. Okay, so it has abhija. And this is a word which is often used in the first of the five hindrances. And in the first of the five hindrances, it means just more or less just desirous or any kind of desire, sensual desire. But here it's used, it's defined much more specifically. Okay, whatever belongs to another, may whatever belongs to another be mine. Okay, so it's specifically having a kind of a strong wish or wanting things that somebody else has. So, you know, may his iPod be mine or whatever. Or...
But I guess this is like the premeditative stealing. Is that what it is?
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like it's on the way to stealing, yeah?
Because, I mean, you can envy an eye of someone's car, say, for instance, but if you think, oh, I really want that car, how can I get it, and how can I go about to take it from them? That's a bit different, isn't
yep.
it?
Yeah.
You engage.
So coveting before the action,
is that what you mean?
Yeah, coveting, but also, you know, and it's phrased in quite a strong way. That wish that those things that those people have was mine. You know, it's like a really kind of strong jealousy and covetousness and wanting to own those things that people
jealousy.
Want. Mm. And then similarly with the second one is the ill will. So it has the ill will. May these beings be slain and slaughtered. Okay, these beings, hanyantu va, vadhantu va, uchijhantu va, vinasantu va, ma va hesunti, may they not be, may they be cut off, perish, and annihilated. Okay? So that's pretty heavy, yeah? But then, you know, it's something that you see. There's a lot of people who wish that, and there are a lot of people who wish other human beings be killed and cut off and destroyed, yeah? Biapana is like ill will or anger. And so this is different words to kill or whatever. So these two are obviously like a pair. Yeah. So we're talking here again. The context was, you know, what's going to send you to hell. So it's like cherishing these kinds of, you know, really unwholesome mindsets. It's not just having a feeling or a thought of ill will or of desire or something like that, but it's really cherishing very unwholesome versions, extreme versions of these things.
It's because these three, if you think about it, are kind of like the greed, hate and delusion. The first one is strong desire, second one is ill will, third one is mitchaditiko, wrong view, having a delusion.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So it's greed, hate and delusion right there. Yeah. So the third one, the wrong view.
So now we can define delusion as mitchaditi.
Well, not define it, but that's a kind of it. It's associated, yeah. The sort of view, there is nothing given. Nati dinnam. Okay, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, nothing hutang, nothing, there's no result of good and bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have by themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. Okay, so yeah, basically a nihilist kind of viewpoint. We believe in nothing, right? So again, that's a very kind of extreme version of a wrong view. It's not just having a different opinion about things, but it's having a view which really undercuts the whole basis of ethical and spiritual life. Okay, three kinds of mental conduct. So this is why people go to hell. And then the same for the Dhammacharya, and of course all the opposite for the righteous conduct. So the... There's a couple of differences here. The one is have the non ill will, thoughts of non ill will is imesata avera abhyapaja anigaha sukhi atanang pariharantu. So anyone who's done the metta chanting would recognize this phrase. This is the phrase that's used for the sabesata avera hantu abhyapaja hantu anigaha hantu sukhi atanang pariharantu. So this is the phrase that's been taken out to use for the metta chant. and has the right view, and so on. Okay, so I'm just going to move on from that positive side, because it's basically just the reverse of the negative side. But if anyone has any questions on it before we go on, comments?
Could you give an example of an action done in this life that ripens in this life?
Well, like you eat a big meal and then you feel sick afterwards.
Yeah.
Look after your kids and they abandon you in old age. Yeah. You ordain as a monk and then you feel happy afterwards. Get married and experience a lot of suffering. Okay, so then we have an Akankheya section. Okay, so similar to how we've had in some of the previous suttas, if one would wish. Okay, so if the lay person would wish. Okay, may after my body's breaking up, my body after I've died, may I be reborn in the Khatiya Mahasala with the great Khatiyas. So the Mahasala is like the upper class, or the upper crust of the Khatiyas, the warrior caste, the government and warrior caste. Sahavyatang being meaning in companionship or in the same group as them. So if you want to, then you can be reborn in that group, or the grouping of the great Brahmins or the great lay people. So notice, of course, the Buddha here taking the perspective of the people who asked the question. And so their question was, well, what is it that makes you want to get reborn in any particular context? So he's just giving a very straight answer to this. And so there's this like combination of things. One is the general thing is that if you do good acts, then you get reborn in a good destination. Okay, and so that will get you somewhere good. But there also seems to be an implication that's more specific. Is here that you're making a specific aspiration to be reborn in a particular place. So it seems that energy or that power that you get from doing the good acts, if you want to focus that and direct it in a particular way, then you can actually, no doubt not 100%, but to some degree you can influence where you're going to get reborn. And elsewhere in Sankhara Upapatti Sutra, it talks about that as well. It's like making a sankhara. So you make some kind of aspiration. And this is something which is still very common in the Buddhist world to do this, even though it's not particularly, coming from a Western background. When we come to Buddhism, we always like to say, oh, we don't want to get reborn anywhere. So the idea of making a rebirth aspiration is a bit foreign to us. But typically most people in Buddhist countries are quite comfortable with and accept the fact that they will be reborn. And they prefer to be reborn in a certain place rather than another. So these kinds of things are quite common. Okay, so Brahmins and so on. And then it goes through the different realms of gods. So the four great kings and the 33 Yama gods, Tusitas and so on. Brahmins retinue, and then right up through the gods of streaming radiance and limited radiance, and gods of glory and limited glory and immeasurable glory and refulgent glory and so on. Great fruit. So these all correspond with different attainments of different jhanas at different levels. We have palang apamana subha, subhakirnaha, and so on. And then through the aviha and atapa and so on, these are the realms accessible, the pure abodes for the anagamis, and then the basis of the gods of infinite space and infinite consciousness and so on and so forth. So, of course, just keeping the precepts by itself isn't enough to get reborn in all of these realms. It's like one of the conditions, but not self-sufficient. Obviously, you have to get practice jhanas to be able to get into these realms as well. And then finally, of course, talking about arahantship. And so one who has good conduct in accordance with Dhamma can also attain arahantship. And again, the same caveat applies. It's not meant to be like a sufficient condition, that's all you have to do to get arahantship, but it's a necessary condition practiced in context of the whole path. So then the householders said, magnificent, Master Gotama, magnificent. And they went for refuge as lay followers. So I mentioned before that this particular sutta doesn't have any corresponding Chinese or Sanskrit versions, but it does have a similar Pali version, the Viranjika Sutta, the next one, which is basically identical, except there it's Viranja rather than the Sala, and a couple of very minor differences in phrasing. So that's it, Majjhima 41 and 42.